From Washington, this is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller with a special recorded episode looking back at the 2020 pandemic.
WHO has been assessing this outbreak around the clock, and we're deeply concerned.
You know, this is really the first coronavirus that I think, at least in recent memory, we've seen impact people so significantly.
What we've learned, what more do we need to know, and its effect on the economy and the arts. We'll have these stories and more next. It's been nearly a year since the first reports of a novel coronavirus originated from Wuhan, China, designated SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. The disease rapidly spread around the world, and on March 11th, the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 could be characterized as a pandemic.
WHO has been assessing this outbreak around the clock, and we're deeply concerned both by the alarming levels of spread and severity and by the alarming levels of inaction. We have therefore made the assessment that COVID-19 can be characterized as a pandemic.
Dr. Zach Jenkins maintains a clinical practice in infectious diseases at Atrium Medical Center and Miami Valley Hospital. And I began our conversation about COVID-19 by asking Dr. Jenkins how far our understanding of the virus has come during the past year.
You know, this is really the first coronavirus that I think, at least in recent memory, we've seen impact people so significantly. We know that there's a significant mortality found with this virus in the elderly and those who are considered higher risk that we wouldn't normally see with the coronavirus. And what makes it so different than the annual flu that we would typically run into? It has a lot of abnormal things that it causes that we don't typically see in a flu. So, for example, there are a lot of microvascular clots that occur as a result of this particular virus, leading to things like stroke, to heart attacks, to pulmonary emboli. So all these complications we really see with this particular virus that we don't normally see with the flu. It is seen to be definitely more associated with mortality than the flu in people that are in that older population group. A little bit less in terms of mortality compared to the flu when it comes to those who are younger. So I would say those would be the biggest differences that we've observed.
And, you know, we have seen the deployment of vaccines and the production of those vaccines far faster than other viruses that have been around, which really speaks to the level of research conducted on SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. But, you know, in your opinion, as someone who works in the infectious disease space, where are the knowledge gaps, if any, that remain?
Well, there are a few things with regards to the vaccine that we still don't know. So we had the Pfizer vaccine that was approved. With the Pfizer vaccine, we don't necessarily know how it will perform in patients who are pregnant or in children. So we don't have that data at this point in time. Another important thing is the phase 3 trial that they used for the Pfizer vaccine to work towards approval only looked at its ability to prevent symptomatic illness. It didn't actually investigate whether or not it was able to prevent asymptomatic transmission. And why that's important is we know about 40% of transmission with COVID-19 tends to be in people who don't have any symptoms at all. So that was actually a big sticking point with the FDA panelists who made this decision. And they really wanted Pfizer to gather some more data on that before they went about unblinding their study participants to possibly receive the vaccine if they hadn't already. So I think that that's an important thing to kind of take away. If we get that transmission data, why that's so important for us, we'll be able to move to the state of those who've received both doses of the vaccine could potentially not have to wear masks anymore. And they wouldn't necessarily have to go about some of these procedures. So there's some areas in knowledge that we still are kind of lacking with regards to that. When it comes to other areas related to COVID, we don't quite understand why it causes all of the clotting, the blood clotting that it seems to be causing in people, which makes it a little bit difficult as far as preventing those issues from happening. We know too that blood thinners we would typically use to prevent clotting, but we don't know whether we should be using high doses that we would use to treat clots to prevent these things from happening, or just lower doses like we would normally use with most other people who are prone to clotting. And then there are a lot of things when it comes to therapeutics as well. There's still some unknowns. We have some things in development, some other artificial antibodies similar to the one that President Trump received. We also have some other theoretical medications that may hit the market, and we're still looking at repurposing older medications that are out there. So at this point in time, the data on that front is a little bit lacking.
Dr. Zach Jenkins practices medicine in the state of Ohio. By December, several COVID-19 vaccines were approved for use and were being distributed. VOA special contributor Greta Van Susteren recently spoke with Francis Collins over Skype. Now, he's the director of the National Institutes of Health, or NIH, in the United States. And she asked him about how messenger RNA plays a role in the vaccines that were being developed by Moderna and Pfizer.
Basically, messenger RNA is the part of a nucleic acid that codes for protein. And this is a very clever way to make a vaccine, where you basically synthesize that messenger RNA that has the right information in it, inject that into muscle. Muscle goes, oh, I know what to do with messenger RNA. I'll make a protein. And so it does. And it makes the spike protein, which is the stuff that decorates the coronavirus. And those spike proteins, the immune system says, oh, no, you don't, and makes an antibody to them. And it's very quick. That's why Pfizer and Moderna are the first two out of the gate, because the messenger RNA approach can be started almost immediately upon the time the virus is isolated. So it is a new approach. It looks extremely promising. It is going to be transformational, I think, for vaccines, for all kinds of things, because it looks like it's really worked. And this is the first time it's been taken all the way through to these phase three trials and FDA approval.
One of the issues, obviously, is going to be distribution, and the Pfizer requires that the vaccine be kept so cold, which, you know, the refrigeration, incredible refrigeration. Why is it, if they're so similar, the Moderna and the Pfizer, one needs to be kept so much colder, which is going to inhibit some of its distribution?
Yeah, it's a great question, and a lot of people puzzled if it's so similar. Moderna can just be kept in a regular freezer and can even be in a refrigerator for a week, and it'll be fine there too. But the Pfizer one, it's wrapped in a different kind of envelope. It's not just the messenger RNA by itself. It's sort of put into an envelope of lipids, and the Pfizer lipid envelope is very sensitive to warming up, which is why it has to be kept at this minus 94 degrees freezer, which isn't available in a lot of places. Moderna's envelope is less concerned about temperature issues, and so it can be stable in a more forgiving way. Coming along, I should say, the next set of viruses, next set of vaccines made by Johnson & Johnson and by AstraZeneca, those are going to be also much more forgiving as far as the temperature requirements. The so-called cold chain will not be nearly as demanding for those, which will be great, especially for places that don't have a lot of freezer capacity, like some of the low and middle income countries that are also going to need these vaccines.
Do AstraZeneca and the Johnson & Johnson have the same messenger RNA approach to a vaccine, or are they different vaccines?
They're using a different approach, one that has been tried and true in other situations, takes a little longer. It basically captures the energy of a different virus, an adenovirus, just as a carrier, a delivery truck, and uses that also to deliver the coding for this spike protein. So it's making the same kind of response happen in the immune system, but it's getting it in a different way. And this is something that's been done successfully for Ebola, so we know this vector system is likely to be safe and effective. The Johnson & Johnson one also is a single dose, which will be very much easier to manage, whereas Pfizer and Moderna requires two doses, one on day one, another one 3 or 4 weeks later. It's a little more complicated to set that up. We'd love it if we had at least one of these that was just one dose and you're done.
I spoke to Dr. Fauci, who works at NIH, several times, but very early on, and we were talking about vaccines, and he said he would be very hopeful with a protection of 50, and that he'd be thrilled with 70. Now we're reading, you know, 94, 95-ish. Is that, you know, the flu isn't that good. The flu vaccine doesn't do that well. With this new approach, messenger RNA, can we expect that we'll relook at, like, flu vaccines, or is it just a completely different category and that we can sort of up the protection there?
I think it's not so much the technology for the vaccine. It's the nature of the actual virus. Influenza has this nasty ability to change its coat every year in a very substantial way. And no matter how clever your vaccine is, if the virus is like completely changed its appearance, the vaccine won't give you immunity anymore. So I don't think we'll be able through this approach to solve the influenza issue. There may be other ways to do that by a universal influenza vaccine. We just seem to be fortunate, though, that coronavirus is particularly susceptible to the vaccine. I didn't dare to hope that we'd end up with efficacy over 70%. And to see these first two coming through at 95% is incredibly exciting and provides a great deal of hope that we will be able to get through the next few months and be able to put this in the rearview mirror.
Francis Collins is the director of the United States National Institutes of Health, and he was speaking to VOA special contributor Greta Van Susteren. In addition to the vaccines approved in the United States and the United Kingdom, both China and Russia have approved vaccines a few months ago that are also in use, and others are also in the pipeline. The novel coronavirus just hasn't infected humans in 2020. It's also left its mark on the economy. I spoke with Maurice Obstfeld, non-resident senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, about not only the financial downturn this year, but also the prospects of a rebound in 2021.
Well, I think in broad terms, it was quite bad and potentially much worse. You know, fortunately, in a number of countries, we also saw unprecedented support of the economy from fiscal authorities and from monetary authorities, which made the contraction worse than it would otherwise have been, you know, to some extent. For example, in the United States, you know, incomes were supported even though people were unable to work. So, you know, the result was a huge contraction in the second quarter. You know, we then saw some bounce back as businesses started to reopen. A year isn't over yet in terms of, you know, the resurgence of the disease that we're seeing now in some parts of the world.
I wanted to ask you about the financial support that a lot of governments gave their citizens during the lockdown periods, whether it be in wage support or in other programs put out there. Because a lot of times they had to put in extra debt to their economies that they weren't planning on. How do you... you know, recover from that?
Well, I think governments had essentially no choice but to do what they did, even though it increased levels of public debt worldwide. You know, the alternative would have been a much sharper contraction and a much slower growth recovery, which could have led ultimately to even more public debt in the form of lower tax revenues over time. So I think governments took exactly the right tack. And in fact, going into 2021, I think they should be providing even more fiscal support and issuing more debt to do that. This, of course, will leave economies post-recovery with higher debt burdens, which they will have to pay off eventually. But I think we need to realize that eventually is probably quite far away. In industrial economies, real interest rates are very low now. There's a lot of negative yielding debt out there, including you know, even corporate debt. And so effectively, some of this borrowing is free. And it's likely that for a very long time, you know, interest rates will remain below economies' growth rates so that the burdens of debt relative to GDP will decline given other factors.
The OECD is forecasting a better future for the world in 2021 with improved economies around the world. And I wanted to get your take on what you think needs to happen you know, throughout the world so that the economy, the global economy, does start to improve.
Well, obviously, the success of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine trials are huge developments, pushing us to be more optimistic so that we can return more or less to normal. But we have to recognize that it's a big world out there. There are many poorer countries where the ability to buy these vaccines and distribute them is going to be less than in the rich countries in the advanced world. And these emerging and developing economies are 40% of the world economy.
That was non-resident senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, Maurice Obstfeld. For many, the COVID-19 pandemic has prompted fear, loneliness, and grief, along with a search for what it means to connect with others. But for Brooklyn-based piano virtuosa Simone Dinnerstein, the first months of the quarantine with her husband and son meant a withdrawal even from music. Her road back was paved by the work of two very different composers who lived more than a century apart, but whose music seems connected. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Dinnerstein about her odyssey and her new album, A Character of Quiet.
That's Simone Dinnerstein playing Etude No. 2 by Philip Glass, the contemporary American composer whose minimalist compositions are well known to classical music and film audiences alike. It's just one of the four pieces by Glass and the 19th century Austrian composer Franz Schubert that matched Dinnerstein's lonesome frame of mind during the pandemic's early days, when it seemed to her as if the world had stopped.
I felt that everybody on Earth was in a way alone at this moment because we couldn't interact with people in real life. You know, we have to use the internet. And it felt just very frightening, almost like being in a science fiction story.
Dinnerstein is a sought-after pianist beloved by global audiences for her solo and orchestral performances on the world's great stages. Before COVID-19, when she wasn't on stage or recording work like this Bach concerto, she was usually at home practicing or listening to music. But with COVID-19, all that changed.
I spent a lot of time going for walks in Greenwood Cemetery, which is a very, very beautiful old cemetery in Brooklyn, very close to where I live, and they were obviously actively burying people there. And it just felt like in the face of all of that, I just didn't feel like making any music at all. And each day was completely unpredictable. Some days I just felt like just being in bed. I was so sad. And then other days I felt hopeful that this was going to end. And then sometimes during the day, those feelings would change.
Dinnerstein credits Adam Abeshaus, her friend and recording producer, with talking her back into music by encouraging her to record on her piano at home. When choosing just what to record during this strange time, she found the unpredictability of her moods mirrored by Franz Schubert and Philip Glass. She had once paired the two composers in concerts to highlight their uncanny similarities. Here's the rondo from the first movement of Schubert's Sonata in B flat, whose initial theme is upbeat.
But then you'll have sudden just anguish and loud. And then it's like the sun comes out immediately after that, and you're just so tender. All of these emotional changes that happen in the music, they were really vivid to me.
Here's a taste of Philip Glass's Etude No. 16 with its own abrupt changes. Dinnerstein also says the unstructured quality of her days felt both circular and surreal.
You know, usually we have goals or deadlines or events that we're looking ahead to, and they were just gone. And so it felt a little bit like we were in a loop.
Dinnerstein also discovered subtly repeating, though subtly varying, musical patterns in both composers' work, as in Philip Glass's Etude No. 6.
Dinnerstein says that being alone together with these great composers was a healing experience for her.
I'm definitely so much better now. Making that album was enormously restorative for me. I don't feel entirely like myself, but I'm much more there.
There is a certain bittersweetness for Dinnerstein when reflecting on the confusion and near despair of those early days. She misses all the unbroken alone time with her husband and son, for one, and the unearthly quiet in the city.
There was something magical about it. Suddenly, you know, having no traffic, hearing all of these birds that we just never, ever heard. I really miss those birds now. So I guess I've taken from that, maybe it's not a good idea to be working every single minute. Like, maybe we need time not working or not being ourselves to find ourselves again.
That was piano virtuosa Simona Dinnerstein. Her album, A Character of Quiet, was released in September by Glass's label, Orange Mountain Music. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In an effort to generate new ideas that will help make development effective, the U.S. Agency for International Development's Global Development Lab has rolled out the Development Innovation Ventures program. It is a rolling system whereby anyone on any subject from anywhere in the world at any time can submit a good idea, said Executive Director of the Global Development Lab Bureau, Harry Bader.
Then the lab will work with them. It is an evidence-based process where it is pay for performance at certain milestones, as well as capacity building and building up a non-traditional partner so that they are an equal contributor to the development in their own country or other countries.
Through the Development Innovation Ventures program, USAID is employing the private sector to develop effective solutions. Take, for example, Phoenix International, said Director Bader.
Phoenix will go out and they'll put a solar array on an individual person's home that can supply a certain amount of electricity over time during the course of a day. And if that person is able to pay that day, they can use their flip phone to let the base know that they've just deposited, let's say, 33 cents for that day's electricity usage. And then through their headquarters, they can contact a satellite where they can then beam down the switch that turns on the solar array. That is an amazing way to expand the use and access to electricity when you are off the grid.
In need of funds to scale up their operation, Phoenix requested an investment from USAID. USAID came up with a grant of under $1 million. Phoenix, now known as NG Energy Access, used that money to expand, invest even more money, and scale up its operations. And so we've created a model to solve a problem that helps corporate shareholders make money delivering a service that is so central, electricity and lights, that can help eradicate illiteracy because you can study, that remediates some of the issues with agricultural production and hunger, and that goes towards economic growth. Because one of the key aspects of eliminating extreme poverty is getting someone connected to the global digital infrastructure, said Director Bader. And this is something that can happen as a result of the model pioneered by Phoenix, but which was funded in part at a critical moment by USAID's Global Development Lab.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.